I'd like a bigger basket tonight. Say, the question is, I can control my mind's attitude about physical pain. Is it possible to learn to control the pain? The attitude is probably the most important aspect of that. Sometimes it is possible to control pain. Sometimes it isn't, in the sense of as one directs attention toward some pain, or when one has an illness, or I think of the time there was an occasion when Ajahn Buddhadasa had an operation. I can't remember what kind of operation it was. It wasn't for a hangnail. It was something a lot more major than that, and he told the doctors not to bother with anesthesia. He would use just samadhi to deal with the pain and deal with the operation. So that in some circumstances one can certainly control the pain, and also there's times when one is sitting for long periods and there's a lot of physical pain, but then when the mind really settles, becomes concentrated, then the pain dissipates. It's quite possible to ameliorate or change the pain just through the experience of beauty and joy and concentration. Pain will dissipate from the body. But sometimes one can't. I can remember Ajahn Chah, he had, after an operation, he had a brain operation, which after the operation, then he didn't take pain medication for a while, just to be able to observe the pain. And he's, you know, pretty adept, but even still, he said, that's painful. It was interesting, because he said that what was most painful was they put a shunt in his brain, and he said what was the most painful was not so much the area of the actual operation, but when they put a tube down into his abdominal cavity, which they pushed through the between the skin and the muscle, I don't know what, over top of the muscle. And he said, oh, that was the more painful part, was that. You know, he had a comfortable attitude towards it, but it was still painful. There's a series of questions about the chanting. Is there anything in the chanting book about stream enterers, non-returners, arahants? Other question, in what way is the chanting book organized? Why does it start with evening chanting? And how does chanting support my practice? There's only a cryptic reference to, what's that phrase? The four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings. So that most people, what is the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings? So it's the stream enterers, once returners, non-returners, arhants, but also both path and fruit, sort of the, so it comes in these pairs, a path and fruit for each stage of liberation. So it's only that kind of cryptic reference. Who knows why they started with evening chanting? Probably was something that they thought was a good idea at the time. You know why? Could be. But that's also what they use in the monastery, and hopefully the monastery starts in the morning. The chanting that we do is a translation, like the evening chanting, morning chanting, is a translation of, it's from the Pali, but it was, written in Thailand about over 100 years ago. And so it was a kind of a rewriting. There's a lot of it that is particularly in the morning chanting, the recollections. Those are sort of passages that are kind of lifted from the suttas, when the reference to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, the Sangha, the recollections are sort of kind of cherry picked from the suttas. So that is where I say, like the evening chanting, there's some of that, but the longer chants are verses that have been written, devotional verses that have been written. It was done by the, I'm not sure if he was the Supreme Patriarch at the time, but he was a royal prince who ordained and then later became, it was very learned, an educating innovator and a reformer. And so he set up a whole curriculum of study for the Thai Sangha. He wrote a whole new books on the discipline. He wrote the chanting, so that he was a prolific scholar, and we inherit that today. Of course, there's also in the chanting book, there's many of the recollections are straight from the suttas, Metta Sutta, the Mangala Sutta, all the highest blessings, the chant on the four Brahma Viharas is straight from the suttas. So there's much that, as well as the three cardinal discourses, there's some which are ancient, say like the dedication of a blessing, the sharing of blessings. Well, that's a chant that comes from very early years of the Theravada in Sri Lanka. So it has been passed on through Sri Lanka, was picked up in Thailand. So there's a lot of sutta-based, scriptural-based, but then there's also some devotional things that are written. The chanting, in terms of supporting our practice, there's lots of it that's embedded in there that are when one's chanting it, it reverberates through the mind, and there's recollections of themes of Dhamma. There's recollections that are conducive to a sense of well-being and confidence, a sense of saddha. There's aspects that by chanting, is one having to put forth effort in a consistent way for a period of time for the chanting. It is for arousing of energy. There's a mindfulness that is needed when one is chanting in a group. So there's lots of benefits that can come from the chanting. I remember reading Ajahn Mahabua, describing or recounting an occasion when, and he was what he was recounting was, say, Ajahn Mun's practice. Ajahn Mun is this the, kind of the kind of the grandfather of the Thai forest tradition. He really reinvigorated the practice, and he's you see, there's only about four pictures of him, and they're all incredibly austere and stern, and he's renowned for his prowess in meditation, meditation skill, psychic powers, his sort of ferocity in training his disciples. But the part of his daily routine in the evening would be to chant for about an hour before he started meditating. But he would chant alone, and so that Ajahn Mahabua would hear chanting coming from his dwelling place. And Ajahn Mahabua relates that he wanted to know what Ajahn Mun was chanting. What were his favorite chants? So that he trying to sneak up, getting close to the dwelling place in the forest, trying to just as he's getting close enough to make out what it was. Then Ajahn Mun stopped chanting, and then he back up. And then Ajahn Mun would start chanting again. So he'd come a bit closer and try to get it. Ajahn Mun would stop chanting. So that of course, is... So then after that, he stopped trying to figure it out. But I thought it's interesting in the sense of this austere, adept meditator is... Yeah, chanting was considered to be an ordinary part of his practice and meditation practice. As part of this retreat, I'm working on the six recollections, but I stumble on two things. And six recollections, these are the anusati, and the anusati, particularly the anusati that are from the suttas, so that recollection of Buddha Dhamma Sangha, recollection of generosity, recollection of virtue, recollection of the devas. And so that as part of this retreat, I'm working on the six recollections, but I stumble on two things. One, on virtue / generosity, the thought, not good enough, is predominant. And two, I've never met a deva, so reflecting on them is difficult and based only on faith. Suggestions. I think one of the things that's really important is to reflect on that voice that keeps sort of saying, not good enough. You're never going to be good enough. You never were good enough. And that is a that's a tendency that undermines wholesome dhammas. That in itself and it's important to see that and to attend to it, that in itself is an unwholesome mental state, that sense of not good enough, that a negative description, commentary of oneself. And of course, those recollections of virtue and generosity are helpful for undermining that tendency, because when one pays attention with in reality, one, you know, anybody who's on kind of made the effort to be on sort of the Abhayagiri monastic retreat, 10 days, is more than well endowed with virtue and generosity. That's a given, and it's important to rationally counter, because the thought of not good enough is not a it's not a rational thought. It's an emotional tone. It's a emotional perception that we carry through. It's also helpful in terms of recognizing how, because sometimes, especially in a kind of Judeo-Christian kind of framework, there's a certain, you know, it's kind of considered virtuous to undermine yourself somehow. that one is not being proud, but the way that, say, when the Buddha describes conceit, I think it's really worth reflecting. The Buddha's description of conceit is when we compare ourselves to others and in terms of I'm worse, I'm equal, I'm better. So that as soon as you start obsessing about me, one's already caught up in conceit. So that you can just drop the whole ball of wax. It doesn't mean to. And then be attentive to the actual activity, the actions that have been rooted in virtue, the actions that have been rooted in generosity. One of the things that I found useful is for undermining that tendency to, you know, that not good enough, is recollecting on a not even just on a daily basis, but on, you know, kind of maybe twice a day, three times a day, to consciously reflect back on the actions that one has done, not going back to the past and not going back to anything beyond that, and as one develops that over a period of time, and sort of really recollecting the things that were unskillful, you know, in that particular that day or that half day or that, is to acknowledge that the things that were skillful, that were wholesome, that were virtuous, that were generous, that were kind, to really acknowledge that, and then whenever the mind goes dragging something from the past, it's not that's past. Keeping that focus on the say the immediate experience within this particular period of time of a day, a half a day, a third of a day, whatever, however one divides it, but to keep that and keep that keeping that going. And what one is doing is building up a database of wholesome and positive memories, associations yeah, the actions that I do are actually overwhelmingly good, overwhelmingly kind, I mean, overwhelmingly generous. And I think it's a really helpful way of undermining that kind of voice, which is self-perception of, not good enough. When we think of devas, deva anusati, I've never met a deva either. In terms of devas being embodiment of goodness, then there's something called manusya deva, the devas that are human. These are good beings that one meets that are examples. And recognizing that, because when one the classical description of the deva anusati, the recollection of the devas in the suttas, is to recollect that these devas who have been reborn in a celestial realm are there because of their actions. And what it is an encouragement to be grounded in wholesome action. And I think with that thought of that actions have results, and good actions have good results. And so one wants to emulate those good actions, so that even if one has never met some celestial deva, one has met good people or people who embody goodness, and it's because of their cumulative the results of the cumulative good action, so that one will, there's a that's a encouragement to emulate or to have confidence in those actions. Also, sometimes one, it's not necessarily a bad thing to base something on faith. Much of science is based on faith. There's faith in gravity. I mean, they still haven't sort of been able to actually pin it down exactly, so that there's a certain faith that we have to go on many, many things, but to consciously sort of, I haven't met a deva, the Buddha says they're around. He talks, gives descriptions, different teachers that seem to be reputable, they talk about them, so that take it on faith. And one knows one's taking it on faith, but that doesn't mean that it's not a valid approach. There was one time where I was sitting with Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah rarely talked about devas and other realms of ghosts or other beings. This one particular day, I was sitting in the front of the monastery with Ajahn Chah, and there was another layman came, and he was a very devoted disciple, student, and solid practitioner, and he actually asked, because of a circumstance that came up, he brought a group of people to the monastery. He lived about a few hundred kilometers away from Ajahn Chah's monastery, and a particular being who said they lived at Motban, like a deva or a spirit, followed that group back, and then kind of entered one of the people, and then made some embarrassing comments about somebody's conduct, pointing it out to them. So it was a bit uncomfortable, and then said they'd come from Utpapal. So then this layman came and said, you know, this is what happened. This is really true. Does this being live here? And then Ajahn Chah said, oh, sure, he lives over such a place. And then he started talking about some of the kind of the different kind of beings that lived at Wat Pa Pong and the karma that they did that got there. I was kind of sitting there with my mouth open. And it's just, one, it was fascinating, but two, it was so out of character for Ajahn Chah. And then it was quite a long discussion, and nobody else was around. And then this layman, he was a railroad engineer, so he got to go back to work. So he headed off back to work, and then this group of people came into the monastery and paid respects, and then they immediately asked Ajahn Chah, you know, Ajahn Chah, Lumpa, is it true there's such things as heavenly realms, and that there's also ghosts and spirits and devas? And Ajahn Chah sort of looked at him and he kind of smiled. He said, if I told you, would you believe me? I said, oh, yes, of course, Venerable Sir. He said, if that's the case, you're really stupid. The Buddha never told people to believe what anybody else said. You have to practice and see for yourself. End of story. So. Okay. What exactly is mudita of the Brahma-vihara, the four Brahma-viharas, and to what degree does it correspond with the popular New Age practice of law of attraction and gratitude? The standard translation of sympathetic joy seems inexact at best. Inexact is a good word. the mudita is the quality of mind that delights in the success and well-being of others. Sometimes that's, if you've got a whole long descriptive sentence or paragraph about one word, it's hard to, they're trying to get a short translation. So sympathetic joy, gladness, it's translated sometimes. But what it is is the delight and joy at the success, at the well-being, at the goodness of others. And one of the qualities that the tendency that it undermines is jealousy or that kind of comparing oneself to others, and And I don't actually even know what the law of attraction is, so I can't really comment on it. But so there is a certain element of, or it's possible that gratitude can play a role. But it's the mudita is that taking delight in the goodness or the success of others. When others are happy, then to be able to experience happiness as well. As a long-time practitioner, I'm often touched by the beauty of the Buddha's words and teachings. And at times when I'm becoming more concentrated, this can feel liberating. And yet I can also sense a deep emotional loss happens at times too. Is this just me or typical as part of the practice? Have you ever experienced this? Certainly that sense of the when one reflects and sometimes sees some of the beauty of the profundity of the Buddha's teachings, there's a real opening and a sense of real freedom, liberation. But it's true that sometimes when there is the experience of an emotional loss, because what is required to to go further, to go deeper, or to even continue to experience that feeling of liberation, or what is pointing to, is that one has to relinquish the sense of self. That sense of I is challenged, there's that initial sort of burst of inspiration, and all of a sudden, I have to give up. It's sort of like, oh crap. But it's that feeling, of course, is from the sense of self. It's with the I have to do it. I have to give up. I'm going to lose something. I'm going to not get what I want. And of course, it's that I that is the problem in the first place. Sort of getting the perspective and recognition of there is and the Buddha talks of it as well, of course I can't think of it right now, but that's where he talks of that sense of sometimes when people hear the teachings they're inspired and they're uplifted, and other times they're challenged. Because it requires a sense of relinquishment, and relinquishment goes against the grain. But of course, when you reflect on it again, what are we relinquishing other than more suffering? So it makes total sense to do it. So it's like when insight and clarity is there, and then there's a real liberation. When the sense of I and me and mine comes in, then there's a feeling of loss that we experience. It's just observing and watching and understanding how that works. What is a good strategy to face an intense invasion of a mix of grandiose, destructive, ugly, and seductive mental formations I couldn't have made up myself? Where do these thoughts, pictures, sounds come from with such a force? Isn't that a waste of time? It is a waste of time, but it does, things stuff happens. So that learning how to sometimes the best way of dealing with really strong proliferations, mental formations as ugly or seductive as they can be, is to really make them into cartoon figures. You can start to create rather than kind of fighting them or getting into conflict with them, trying to annihilate them, riding in on one's white horse of the Dharma and conquering them, conquering these evil thoughts, making them into cartoon characters and making them absurd. Because that's what's really, you can really let them go when you see the absurdity of some of the thoughts and feelings and moods and impressions. And we can really take it seriously and get really wound up when we're righteous about it, or we're sort of intimidated by it, in the sense of, I'm supposed to be on this monastic Thanksgiving retreat, and here I'm thinking all these miserable thoughts. What's wrong with me? But they're just thoughts, and just to be able to make them into cartoon characters, draw mustaches and spectacles on them. I mean, it's to do anything to make them kind of absurd. They're just thoughts, and they'll dissipate on their own. Can you say more about how the heart, the jai, stays here, and the mind, the jitta, investigates, moves out? Especially those of us who are taught that jai is heart mind, so that Lumpu Te, in the story that I told, his use of and distinction between jit and jai are completely idiosyncratic to him, particular to him. I haven't heard any other teacher use that same terminology. But I think what he's trying to do is trying to make a distinction between the fundamental heart mind, because that's generally there's not a distinction between heart mind, like in English the heart is more the emotional base, the mind is more the intellectual rational base, and there isn't really that distinction in either Pali or Thai, and the way that Ajahn Tate is using it is more like the way of how Ajahn, when I recounted the teaching of Ajahn Mun, and looking at mind and mind objects, in the sense that mind being the fundamental quality of knowing, and the mind objects of all the movement, thoughts, the mind directs its energy towards, so that Ajahn Tate tries to make that distinction using jai and jit, and in English it's then translated to heart and mind, but it is a helpful distinction in the sense that there, having this And as in the story, where Ajahn Tait is saying that there is this quality that is kind of neutral, it's central, it's even, it's not shaken by moods. It's the fundamental kind of ground of knowing. And then once the mind moves out from that, then it's endless where it goes to, what it does. And to be able to return to that and not to worry about concentrating the mind, but using the attention and awareness to recognize that underlying quality of the mind, the heart, that is clear and even. Please speak about antidotes to the judging mind. I think one of the ways as an antidote to the judging mind is to make it clear, because sometimes the judgments are there, and we believe that, and then we go on to the proliferations descriptions of the people in the world and ourselves around it, and we don't actually recognize when, or we don't articulate when those judgments are made, so that to using the mindfulness and attention to recognize when the mind is making a judgment, in that sense of and of course, we're not going to catch that right in the first millisecond when we first start doing it, but starting to view experience from that perspective. When are judgments made? How do I make those judgments? What's going on there? And so that seeing that more clearly, how that judgment is formed in the mind, and then to take note of that, to highlight it, to question it, and sort of say, really? Is that really what it is? Because we work from an assumption of their truth and their reality, and to be able to see that clear, and again, sort of, because I mean, the nature of the judging mind will tend to make a judgment about the judging mind, and then you start spinning yourself out with that. But to just be taking attention and investigation, and start to recognize when those judgments start to form. How do they start to form? And then just to really hold a mirror up to that and say, really, is that really true? Is that really it? And you'll find what will happen is one, that proliferations tend to stop, or the projections, and then there will just a very natural relinquishment will take place. I find myself struggling with staying in the moment, stop planning for the future, or being too obsessive with planning. There are so many recent catastrophes: Storm Sandy, flood in Thailand, earthquakes, etc. My aging parents are worried. Emergency preparedness kits stirs up more anxiety. It seems never enough. My question is, to what extent does one plan for a disaster, and how do I gently or compassionately explain that to my parents using wise words from Dhamma? Well, when I'm thinking, probably don't even If your parents are that much worried, then wise words from Dhamma might not make much of a dent, actually. but you could always use wise words from Winnie the Pooh. And then there's one Pooh and Piglet walking. There was a bit of a storm and wind was blowing. They're walking through the 100-acre wood. And of course, Piglet is a bit prone to anxiety already. And so he's getting worried. Pooh, what happens if the wind blows and a branch comes down and hits us? And then Pooh sort of stopped for a minute and said, what if it didn't? So we plan for all these disasters and worry about disasters and project onto disasters and most of them don't happen. I'm also thinking of something Mark Twain said. I can't remember exactly, but sort of something to the extent of I've had all these. Had to think about all these bad things that have never happened to me. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was to that extent, that vein. So obviously, to some extent, one prepares oneself, but endless preparations for all of the things that could go wrong it keeps one in a state of fear and dis-ease, so that it's incredibly counterproductive. Is it really possible and or realistic to keep people in your heart but not in your life? Well, yeah, there's some people, in the sense that one, because one of the things that loving kindness is, if one translated it directly from the Thai, it's sort of well-wishing. One's wishing others well. In the English, when we think of of loving kindness or I've got to love this person or I've got to have loving thoughts towards them, sometimes it's a bit much. But one can wish them well without having to, because you don't necessarily even have to like people to wish them well. And you don't necessarily have to, one recognizes the complications and difficulty of a particular person or situation, and it's also there's a need to, let's say, have a certain kindness towards oneself in some circumstances with some people. It's not necessary to get entangled and to One can still wish them well, but just not to be entangled with them, or not to be bound up in their life or their complications. Besides my own Dhamma practice, raising my children is also very important to me. We want them to grow in wholesome Dhammas. I was interested in your ideas around this. Currently, because they have shown interest in our keeping the five precepts, we talk about how the day went in keeping the precepts as we tuck them in at bedtime. They report on how it went, and so does whichever parent is tucking them in, each of us looking at ourselves, our intentions, and our behaviors, and then sharing. Are there additional things we might do as parents to help our kids as we travel the path? That's pretty amazing already. So that, you know, certainly just the actual speaking openly without preaching, modeling conduct, modeling behavior that is wholesome. These are certainly some of the best ways. And so that, as parents, to be speaking with one's children about the precepts, about virtue, about the effects that it has, not so much in terms of having to do this, having to do that, but really reflecting on the results of actions and the results socially and internally. What does it feel like? I think in the end, the biggest impact is one's own, as parents, one's own example. I can remember Ajahn Chah saying and just pointing out very parent asking what to do in terms of trying to raise their children in a way that of Dhamma, and he said, "Well," said, "it's like this. You know, you've got a tree over here, and you've got a tree over here, and then a vine grows up around." Right here, close to this tree, you know, which tree is that vine going to curl itself around? Is it, well, it's going to be this one. So, that's what parents the closeness of the parents is what is going to be a major effect on the children. So that modeling of good conduct and also. Being able to speak about it, bring it up in ways that are meaningful to them and are not it's encouraging, but it's not stifling. I'm experiencing the watcher observing. I'm experiencing the observer watching the breath, but remember a previous, more unified space that I am in the body or breath field, not aside from it, as the watcher. How do I get back in? Does this come with the mind-heart quieting down more? This desire is dukkha, and there's awareness of that too. Yeah, there's all these different ways where you create dukkha, isn't there? That recognition. Oh yeah, this trying too hard is dukkha. The mind trying to set up that comparing to an ideal, getting caught by the watcher, and just really observing that and allowing that feeling of dukkha to be present And then what happens is when there's a certain release from that, and then taking an interest, and it's just taking an interest in the breath, taking an interest in that process of relaxing and releasing, relinquishing, settling. Those are the kind of the watchwords of just putting stuff down. There's a short book at the monastery about using the kind of ever-present high-pitched buzz, also known sound of silence. I think it's by Ajahn Amaro or Ajahn Sumedho. Could you comment on how to use the sound of silence as an insight practice? Ajahn Sumedho is a teacher who really used that as his personal practice. Ajahn Amaro, as a close student of Ajahn Sumedho, has used it, and I haven't really developed it at all. So I can only have conjectures about that. And certainly, the basis of insight is always around the sense of recognition of impermanence, unsatisfactory, non-self, and so that whatever experience to be paying attention to that non-self nature, or the ways that we create that sense of discontent or dissatisfaction, recognizing the uncertain, unsure nature of whatever experience it is, so that one can use that whatever meditation one's using, those basis of insight is fairly consistent. So coming back to that foundation. Okay, how can we better hinder the five hindrances? Or does that just create another hindrance? Well, I think one of the ways that the how the Buddha phrases it is, we tend to either feed the hindrances or we can starve them. So if we feed them, then they can be quite healthy and frisky, and if you starve them, you put them on a diet, and they start to weaken, so that's a good way of viewing it. If we, because we do sort of create another hindrance, just trying to. When we conceive of, okay, how can I hinder the hindrances? But feeding and starving is a good point. Oh, really? Oh, okay. Here's an advertisement from your sponsors? It's a Spirit Rock Day Long in December, next month, on the Five Hindrances with Ajahn Yatiko and Ajahn Kruner Dhammo. What date is that?
December, sometime around Christmas.
That would be a good Christmas present. Please explain, this is the last question, please explain the fourth precept, especially the idle talk part. Seems like we lay people have idle talk all the time. Are we breaking this precept every day without knowing it? Well, it's not just the lay people. I can vouch for that. So the idle chatter. What is it? False speech, harsh speech. Yeah, the last one. I guess it's the last one. Sampam, and it's the word in Pali. This is one of the words in Pali that completely describes. Even if you don't know the language, it completely describes what you're doing. Sampapalapa. Sat. So that, just idle, frivolous, empty, not necessary conversation. And, you know, as a training, it's very human, of course, to be engaged in conversation and socializing. But you know, much of it can be a real waste of time and energy, and then not only does it sort of waste time and energy, but it usually sort of starts, you know, as the ball gets rolling, then it usually starts spinning off in other directions of gossip or backbiting or something else, so that that training in recognizing skillful speech, wholesome speech. And I think one of the things again where one investigating the mind to see what is the underlying volition and intention behind, so that this wholesome and skillful intentions and unwholesome, unskillful intentions, so that sometimes with, just in human discourse, there needs to be some kind of chatter, but it's usually far beyond what is necessary. But coming back and recognizing, well, what is the intention? And sometimes, you know, just the, you know, it's an unwholesome intention to when one can't, or a volition, when one can't just sort of be quiet. Or be present, and not be compelled to adding more verbiage to a situation. Sort of that compulsion, that restlessness comes from restless energy, which is if one investigates and you sort of reckon, well, it's really unskillful, it's really unwholesome, it's not necessary. So that gaining an increase of clarity and steadiness, and then one of the benefits of say right speech is that it's timely, it's fruitful, it creates a sense of trust and confidence in those who hear it, whereas, sort of the kind of the idle chatter rarely has that impact. Okay, I managed to get through, and I actually sort of say, okay, I'm not going to go longer than 8:15. It's 8:15 on the button. And we can have a short break and come back for evening puja.